Okay, welcome back. Sorry for the late start. Today we're going to continue with ATM networks. We left off just after we finished the PNNI routing part. Okay, we're going to continue into traffic management building blocks which are provided in the ATM architecture. And then we're going to go on to the MPLS architecture or multi-protocol label switching architecture and just study label switching as an abstract idea. So that's going to be the for the two classes today. Okay, so let's get to the slide set. So the first thing you're going to study is traffic management in ATM is pretty much like traffic management on the roads. Okay, there are some analogies, and there are not some great analogies. Okay, so so traffic management all about is, I mean, there is one way of looking at traffic management is that you want to prevent traffic jams. Okay, or you want to manage traffic jams if they do occur. Okay, the other way of looking at traffic management is that you want to provide priority lanes for users who pay more, or in the real world traffic, you want to provide priority lanes for sort of carpooling lanes and so on and so forth, right? So we will be looking at capabilities whereby you can offer different types of services on top of a single network. So it's the same highway, but you're providing different services to different users. Okay, so that is the basic idea of being able to support multiple services on a single platform. Okay, in this lecture, we'll just cover the architectural ideas. Okay, we will look at quality of service in a little more detail in a later set of lectures. Okay, where we'll clearly understand what the building blocks are from a theoretical point of view. But right now, the issue is only to look at it from an architectural point of view. What are the abstract things you need to do to get it right? Okay. So some of the things you need to do are, you want to do some kind of an admission control, and here it's called CAC, which stands for Connection Admission Control. When a virtual circuit shows up, in other words, you try to signal a virtual circuit, you say yes or no. I can accept you or not. Okay, so this CAC function is done at every switch along the path during the signaling. Okay, if you don't need any particular resource and you just want to set up a path, usually there's nothing to be done in CAC. And the CAC is needed only if you want some kind of resource for quality of service. Okay, so that's part of the CAC function. Then once you have set up the signaling and you show up in terms of your traffic can be shaped before they enter the network. Okay, the whole idea of shaping is that the statistical profile of traffic which is being offered to the network may not match the statistical profile that was agreed upon during the connection setup phase. So what you do is you basically shape the statistical profile of the incoming traffic so that it fits what was agreed to, okay, or what was agreed to during the contract. Okay, and that is known as traffic shaping, or it's also known as traffic conditioning in internet circles. Okay, now if you've been to California or some other places where there's lots of traffic, there are ramp lights. Okay, before you enter the freeway itself, there are lights. Okay, and the whole goal is that the rate at which cars are allowed into the freeway depends upon the amount of traffic that's already there on the freeway. Okay, so similarly, so ramp lights are like shaping. You want to manage the traffic profile entering the network. Okay, and you want to manage the burstiness of traffic entering the network. Okay, so that is the idea. Okay, and sometimes we use the word traffic envelope. Okay, the word traffic envelope means that, okay, envelope is just like when you send a letter, the envelope bounds the letter. In other words, everything within the envelope is what the letter is. So similarly, when you say traffic envelope, it is like a statistical bound on what you can offer me. So you are, and we say that we shape your traffic to fit the traffic envelope or agreed upon traffic envelope. Okay, and then one function as part of this is something known as usage parameter control. This is like the traffic cop, which comes and says that if you violate your contract, that is if you send more than what you're supposed to, or you're speeding or something like that, right? So you can be penalized. Okay, this penalty can be of various forms. Okay, it can be like setting the discard eligible bit, which we saw in frame relay, which essentially marks you for higher priority to be dropped. Okay, So you're more likely to be dropped if you do. There are other ways of managing misbehaving flows. You can actually drop them right at the entrance or drop them inside the network or provide some sort of penalty for them. So that's like the traffic cop. Okay, and within the network, you can have a variety of scheduling schemes. So either at the edge of the network or inside the network, you can drop a packet. Okay, there's no equivalent of this in real traffic. Okay, you can't just take a car and drop it, whereas you can take a packet or a cell and drop it. Okay, so and in general, there is for congestion control, there's also some feedback mechanisms, which is like the radio, which tells you where there is traffic or there are signs saying there's a traffic jam upcoming and so on. So that's an example of feedback. Obviously, the feedback mechanisms in real traffic situations are very rudimentary, okay, whereas in network feedback is highly sophisticated. Okay, so these are the kinds of mechanisms. So that's the big picture. So this is what we talked about. Okay, this is very hard to read, but essentially two terms we come across are admission control and usage control or parameter control. Okay, so admission control is done when you set up the connection or when the signaling call comes in, you do admission control. Okay, that's when CAC is done. And when actual data traffic comes in or in the data plane, you do usage parameter control. This is usually called shaping conditioning type functions. Okay, so we're going to look at the latter functions, so usage parameter control. Okay, so now usually, or even both admission control as well as usage parameter control depends upon a bunch of parameters. Okay, so essentially the user wants to show up with a signaling call and says that I want so much bandwidth, say I want this kind of bandwidth guarantee, I want this kind of delay guarantee, and I want this kind of loss guarantee. Okay, and you capture it using some kind of parameters. Okay, people have tried very hard to make it a small and simple list. Okay, to some extent they have succeeded, but if you look at this list, it sounds very complicated. Okay, but the list is actually fairly simple in concept. One simple traffic parameter is peak cell rate, which says what is the maximum traffic you can offer to the network, okay, in terms of the cell. Remember that the difference between peak information rate in frame relay and peak cell rate is that this is specified in terms of cells per second, okay, whereas in frame relay you specify it as frames per second. Frame can be considerably larger than a cell, okay, and in fact you can have multiple, a single frame relay frame mapped to multiple cells. Okay, so it's not one and the same thing, but the concept is similar. Okay, so sustained cell rate is like an average over a period of time. Okay, and you can sometimes think of it like a minimum cell rate. Okay, and minimum cell rate is actually a separate parameter which is specified. So sustained cell rate is like an average. A minimum is an absolute minimum. Okay, so these are major parameters. But not only do you specify a rate parameter, usually also specify some limits on bursting. Okay, now what does bursting mean? Suppose I'm sending at the peak cell rate. Okay, over a long term average I send below my sustained cell rate, but on a short term, how long can I send for peak cell rate? Can I send for an unbounded period of time at peak cell rate? Yes or no? Okay, so it turned out that analysis became very hard if you send at the peak cell rate for an unbounded period of time. So they wanted to bound the time for which you can use the peak cell rate. So peak cell rate is not a carte blanche, you can't just use it directly. So you can only use the peak cell rate for a given amount of time or a given number of bits. And that number of bits is given by maximum burst size or burst tolerance is a time parameter. So essentially the idea is that you're allowed to send it up to the peak cell rate, but you can't send more than so many cells, so many packets at the peak cell rate. And on the long-term average, you're allowed to send sustained cell rate, okay? And you can also specify a third parameter saying that it's the lower bound on your rate, saying this is my minimum rate, okay? Now, so this is all, these are all rate parameters. Now, if I look at delay parameters, you can say what is the maximum delay I can tolerate, or cell transfer delay as it's called, CTD. And a measure of the variance in cell delay is called cell delay variation, okay? So remember that this is important when we are trying to do a CBR service or trying to map a telephone call which is highly synchronized to an ATM network. I'd like the ATM network to offer me very tightly controlled delay as well as tightly controlled bandwidth service. Okay, Because only then I don't need to do a lot of adaptation at the end of the ATM network, beginning and end of the ATM network, so that I can easily map my telephone calls on top of an ATM network. Okay, so these parameters are often specified primarily for CBR, but for video services like VBR, you also specify them. Okay, so video also, if you're trying to do a video conference, it's something more than a phone call. Okay, so you, even though the picture part of it can tolerate some variation in delay, you cannot tolerate an unbounded amount of variation. Okay, so you want to bound the amount of variation, and you can specify such a bound by saying cell delay variation tolerance, or this is a bound, or you can provide provide this tolerance parameter on a statistical quantity known as peak-to-peak CDV. Okay, I'll talk about what that is. Anyway, so the other parameter is the loss side of things, where you can specify a cell loss ratio. Okay, and this is similar to the frame loss ratio we saw in frame delay. Okay, so in terms of cell delay variation, essentially what you need to realize that when you send packets through a network, they sit in queues and they encounter random amount of delays and go through the network, right? Each cell, as it goes from input to output, sees a delay, okay, cell transfer delay, and it's a random variable, okay? And like all random variables, these can be distributed, and typically, if you are having a well-controlled service, right, the distribution looks some kind of a bell-shaped curve, like normal distribution. I mean, if you're not guaranteeing anything for cell delay, then the distribution will not look normal. But if you're trying to provide a VBR service or a CBR service, it'll look like a normal distribution. It won't be exactly like a sharp delta function at a single point, but it'll be like a normal distribution, which is the next best thing. Then what you can do is you can take a few deviations around the mean and say that I want to control my delay to be within this. Okay. Now, if you studied resonance and so on, this is similar to the Q factor, where you also have you specify a peak-to-peak type quantity for resonance. Okay, so this is a parameter. You can either specify for a few standard deviations around the mean, this is the delay I want to tolerate, or you can specify it in terms of quantiles. Okay, so remember that quantiles is like medians and so on. Median is a 50% quantile, right? So cell transfer delay, on the other hand, is an absolute quantity. It's not a variance. Okay, it's not a spread. It's an absolute quantity. Anyways, so, but the whole point is that if you take any service, right, we are not going to crank through this, but just to give you an idea, each service, you might specify a bunch of these parameters. So a service is fully specified when you have a bunch of rate, delay, and loss parameters that are specified. Okay, now the simplest service is the UBR service, okay? You should always look at the simplest thing first, okay? UBR, you see, most of them are unspecified. That's why it's called UBR. It's unspecified bitrate. Okay, and it is possible that you will specify the peak rate. Okay, you can't burst beyond a point. Okay, and sometimes the cell delay variation tolerance may be specified, but it's usually not. Whereas if you look at a other end of the spectrum, if I take a CBR or a constant bitrate service, you will specify a peak rate. There is no meaning for a sustained cell rate because the peak rate is the same as a sustained cell rate. So you remember that when I talked about statistical multiplexing gain, there is no meaning for statistical multiplexing gain if the peak is the same as the average, right? So CBR service does not give you any statistical multiplexing gain. So therefore, only you specify the peak rate and not some of these other things. So these are meaningless quantities. But you do specify limits on peak-to-peak cell delay variation and maximum cell delay, self-transfer delay and the CLR limits and so on. But you don't use CBR as an example of an open loop service. In other words, there's no feedback in CBR. Okay, whereas in fact there's no feedback for most of the services except ABR. ABR stands for available bitrate, and you can actually think of it as like adaptive bitrate. So you have some feedback from the network which tells you that I have capacity to carry your traffic, so send me a cell. Okay. So cells are sent into the network dynamically only when there's capacity available. That way you can reduce the buffering required in the network. And also you can reduce the cell loss which happens inside the network. It doesn't say anything about what will happen outside the network. You could queue up a lot of traffic at the edge of the network. Like this is typically what happens if you go to California and so on, right? Sometimes you might face a queue inside the network, that is inside the freeway, and often you might be just sitting at the edge of the network at the ramp itself for a while, okay, trying to get into the freeway. So ABR is like a network where most probably you'll be waiting at the ramp rather than inside the network, whereas UBR is a scheme where most probably you'll be sort of waiting through traffic inside the network. Okay, well, this analogy sounds makes you think that ABR is probably much more superior to UBR. I mean, UBR is a very simple service, okay, and in real world, usually simplicity wins out, unless the addition of complexity has a huge gain. Okay, so most networks do implement UBR. In fact, all switches do implement all of this stuff, but what is turned on is usually CBR and UBR, okay, and GFR in some places. Okay, so I said at the edge of the network, once you have admitted a session, now you have to police the session to its traffic envelope or to its profile, agreed upon profile. So, and I think we've looked at this earlier also. I mean, you have a bunch of tokens which come into this bucket, and when traffic shows up, you claim a token and move in. And the reason you have a limited bucket size, it captures the notion that you want to allow only a limited amount of burst. Okay, so for example, if this bucket is empty and there comes a packet, you will have to stand in a queue waiting for a new token to come, otherwise you cannot get it. And as you stand in the queue here, you are essentially reducing the burstness in the network. Even though the input profile to this token bucket was bursty, you don't allow an unbounded burstiness to enter the network. So you allow only bounded burstiness and a bounded rate to enter the network. Okay. So it is possible for you to cascade a bunch of leaky buckets. One leaky bucket can implement the peak rate limit, and another leaky bucket can implement the minimum rate or average rate limit. Okay. So there are specifications in the ATM standards which allow cascades of leaky buckets to handle the policing of different rates. Okay, so that's how you take care of the services. So the one of the algorithms, which is essentially a variant of the leaky bucket algorithm that is specified in ATM, is called GCRA. It stands for generic cell rate algorithm. Okay, now we'll just cut through the chase and come to this diagram here. Essentially, what the GCRA does is you can focus on this red line and this yellow line. Okay, what it means is that suppose the last cell arrived at this boundary, okay, and now what you do specify is a parameter called I, okay, which stands for the inter-cell time, and says that this is the rate at which I will be sending packets on the average. Okay, this could be a peak rate or average rate or whatever. Okay, now if a packet shows up before this agreed upon parameter, okay, within this yellow bound, I will be able to take it. Okay, but if it arrives too early, I will discard it. Okay, in other words, I will not accept it. Okay, there are two ways to deal with the packet that comes too early. One is make it wait till it conforms, or just throw it at the edge, throw it out at the edge itself. Okay, so different schemes implement different ways of policing that. So that's all it means. Okay, so if a packet shows up later than its limit, that's okay. There's nothing lost for the network. So I'll just reset my interval to start here. Okay, that's all GCRA is. It just specifies these two parameters. This L parameter specifies the limit of time where I can accept a packet that comes early. Okay, and there is a bound on how many packets I can accept early. Okay, and that bound is defined by the total number of tokens in the bucket. Okay, so it's just an alternate way of interpreting the token bucket. Okay, and in fact, GCRA is meant to be an abstract representation, and you can implement it with the token bucket. Okay, so there are two ways to implement GCRA. One is known as a virtual scheduling algorithm. Okay, so there is a parameter called theoretical arrival time. This is exactly what we saw. That is that red line, right, where the beginning and end of that red line. If I show up at a time after the theoretical arrival time, then you are a late packet, so I don't care. I'll accept you. If you are an early packet, early bird, I can accept you only if you're not too early. Okay, that's about it. Okay, so there is one more algorithm which I'll not crank through right now, but essentially this is a leaky bucket interpretation that's known as a virtual scheduling interpretation. But both of them do exactly what I showed you in the picture. Okay, so this is an example of GCRA. So here is on the top line, or here, are a set of arrivals, and at the bottom line you have a set of theoretical arrivals, theoretical expected arrivals. Okay, now if these arrivals show up at these points of time, this is an example of a profile that will be accepted. But here is a profile where I have multiple arrivals coming too early, right? Then essentially I will not accept this, okay, or I will delay it to make sure that they will conform to the specification which is being agreed. Okay, that's exactly what it means. Okay, so, and the maximum burst size parameter says that even if you arrive within that L parameter, okay, I will not accept an unbounded number of these L's. Okay, there is a limit on the number of such early bird arrivals that I will accept. Okay, that puts a bound or a limit on how much you can burst. Okay, anyways, so there are complex formulas which relate all these parameters together, but I think that is not important to realize. It's all you want to realize is that this is a simple method for enforcing a rate contract. Okay, if I negotiate a rate, you are supposed to keep within the rate. The reason I need to police is that applications might not do their own policing. Okay, you might ask, why the heck does the network have to police? Okay, it's an unnecessary function of the network, right? Network is still just basically protecting itself. And if the application could police itself, there's no need for the network. Okay, network polices because if you take standard applications like TCP in this case, TCP can say generate bursts of traffic. Okay, it was not designed keeping ATM in mind. So it can generate bursts of traffic. So the network certainly has to protect itself and space these packets out. Okay. Okay, so what we talked about was at the edge we talked about a policing entity, and what we did not talk about was at the core of the network there is something known as a scheduling entity which makes things happen. Okay, now that part is a little more involved discussion and we will defer that to the quality of service lecture. Okay, so in fact it's a very fascinating discussion. Now the other traffic management capability which ATM provides is provided only in one service, and that service is known as available bitrate. Okay, now this primarily has become a theoretical curiosity because it's probably the most powerful feedback scheme ever deployed. Okay, and ABR, as I said, essentially is a simple distributed callback mechanism, and what I mean by that is when the network has capacity, the flow will be informed. Okay, and the flow will then send a cell. Okay, the way the network informs that it has capacity, or it's the inverse of that information, that is, I'm congested, is by either by setting a single bit, okay, or an alternative algorithm where some of these cells are special cells known as resource management cells, and on these cells you actually set a rate, okay, which is known as an explicit rate scheme, where the network not only tells that I'm congested or not congested, it actively asks the source to transmit at a particular rate. Okay, remember that if I tell you a single bit, it's like yes or no or increase or decrease type information, whereas if I tell you a rate information, I'm precisely telling you what rate you should be going at. It's much more detailed piece of information. Okay, so explicit rate can be shown to do much more sophisticated control than a single bit scheme. Now, so those are the two basic models, and what you do once these bits have been set is that the destination can do some statistics on the number of bits, and then it can send back a resource management cell to the source saying exactly how much do I predict that you should reduce your rate. So then essentially the destination source together are guessing the level of the network congestion and then adjusting themselves. To some extent, this is similar to what TCP does in terms of increase and decrease. So when you do increase and decrease, you're guessing, you're playing a guessing game. Okay, but you're trying to play a conservative guessing game so that you don't, wreak havoc on the network. You want to make sure the network is stable. Okay, so network stability is one of the most important problems. Okay, that's why congestion control is so important. So you are, by naturally, you're conservative, whereas in an explicit rate scheme, since the network itself tells you how far you want to go, you can be fairly aggressive in terms of both the overall utilization of the network as well as the relative sharing of the network between several flows. Okay, so we are not going to study this any more than that. I mean, these are just the outline of the overall schemes. ATM also provides you to break up a large network into pieces called segments. Okay, or segments. So this is also called virtual segments, or it's virtual source, virtual destination pieces. So here you can, instead of having a huge feedback loop from the source to destination, which might involve a lot of delay, you can have smaller feedback loops. Either it could be, again, the small feedback loop could be a bit-based feedback loop, or it could be a rate-based feedback loop. Okay. Now, obviously, this is far more complex, okay, and this is less implemented than the basic end-to-end stuff. Okay. So the last type of service which we shall study, is the guaranteed frame rate. Now, the guaranteed frame rate is meant to closely emulate the frame relay service. In the frame relay service, what you do is you have a minimum cell rate and a maximum rate, right? The peak information rate. So, exactly what you do in the GFR service is you provide a frame-based service. Okay, in other words, instead of providing a minimum cell rate, you provide basically a minimum frame rate. Okay, that's the only difference, because the frames can be of variable sizes. Okay, so the So I think that's the only difference. That's a major difference in terms of UBR versus GFR. So you can think of it as GFR is just UBR plus, which closely emulates frame relay service. So the advantage of this is that ATM networks can serve as frame relay backbones. In other words, you can offer frame relay to your customers and then aggregate these frame relay connections onto an ATM network and carry it almost unmodified. Okay, that's what this service is for. And it has very things very similar to a frame relay, like a CLP bit or a cell loss priority bit, which is almost exactly the same as the discard eligible bit, where the only difference is the discard eligible bit was for a single frame, whereas CLP bit is for a cell. Okay, so and then instead of minimum cell rate, you have, I mean, instead of CIR, you have minimum cell rate. Okay, so what we've done is I've just given you an outline of some of the key ideas of ATM so far. ATM was an extremely popular technology in the mid-90s, okay, and slowly its popularity has died, primarily because it was slower to take off, okay, and probably more so because the mapping of IP to ATM was very, very hard, okay. In fact, it was hard in practice. And the alternative was try to take ATM and go all the way to the end systems, which is called end-to-end ATM or native ATM, and that vision didn't occur, okay, because that vision was stopped short by the emergence of fast Ethernet and gigabit Ethernet. Okay, so what happened was ATM was caught in a between a rock and a hard place, and then it has been primarily deployed in the cores of the Internet. Okay, and even the core of the Internet, till around mid-90s, ATM switches were far faster than IP routers. Okay, and it was far more reliable, and it offered many more services. Okay, so it was a no-brainer to ask, okay, can I take IP and at least map it to ATM and make it work? And the ATM people were quite open to internet working. That is, they wanted to make sure that ATM could carry anything on top of it, and it can also run on anything below it. So, as I mentioned, so IP or ATM was a big study. Okay, but then they found that this problem was not as simple as thought. Okay, in fact, the problem is very easy to formulate. Okay, and I shall show you in a moment. Okay, hang on. Before showing you complex diagrams, I can just specify the problem very easily. Okay, now IP is a protocol that offers a connectionless packet service, right? ATM is a protocol that offers connection-oriented or a virtual circuit-based service. Okay, now whenever you want to run one protocol on top of the other protocol, such a model of inter-networking these two protocols is known as an overlay model. What are you doing? You're taking one protocol and running it over another protocol, right, without changing the protocols themselves. So what you're doing is you're just specifying the glue between the protocols. Okay, this means you are running the protocols one over the other. Okay, so this is commonly called an overlay model of internet networking. Okay, I think I mentioned this before when I generally discussed internet networking. Another way is to sort of translate one protocol to the other, which sort of breaks down very fast. Okay, like bridging is an example of translation where you try to bridge between an Ethernet segment and a token ring segment and so on, right? So that was abandoned long time back. So it was thought that the only way to do internet networking was to do overlaying. That is, take IP unmodified, take ATM unmodified, and try to map it, okay? And similarly, there are, and I shall show there are a couple of approaches of mapping that, or three or four approaches actually. But the central problem in an overlay model is the following. You have addresses called IP addresses, and you have addresses called ATM addresses, okay? And you have packet formats called IP packet format, and you have packet formats called ATM packet format or ATM cell formats. Okay, you have IP routing protocols, and then you have ATM signaling protocols. Okay, when you talk about unmodified mapping, you need to map all this stuff to each other. Okay, so this reels, whenever I say mapping, right, it's sometimes called address resolution, for example. If I want to map IP addresses to ATM addresses, it's called address resolution. Similarly, we saw when IP addresses were mapped to Ethernet addresses, that was also called address resolution, right? So there the address resolution problem became very simple because you can take IP addresses and just throw a packet on the network as a broadcast and ask, does anybody have the Ethernet address or layer 2 address corresponding to this IP address? And you'll get a reply back and then you can send the packet. Okay, now address resolution is usually done in the data plane. Okay, when packets show up, you want to actually do the address resolution. But when you're trying to map a connectionless protocol like IP on top of a connection-oriented protocol, you have to do address resolution at the time of actually the connection setup or the VC signaling. Okay, And another problem in ATM is that you don't have a broadcast paradigm. ATM is a point-to-point network, or what's known as a switch network. You can't throw a packet on ATM network and say, send this to everybody. It won't go. Okay, it's not a broadcast medium. It's also, it's more specifically called, it's called a non-broadcast medium access. Okay, it's a non-broadcast network. Therefore, the ARP method of doing address resolution cannot work. Okay, so you need to come up with an alternative for address resolution. That is one of the fundamental problems of internet working. Okay, we shall see that that became extremely complex in ATM. Okay, the second problem was to map packet formats to packet formats. That problem was solved relatively easily in ATM. Okay, and that the solution for that is known as in a particular RFC called 1483. Okay, essentially what they took is they took an IP packet and either put it in an Ethernet packet or put it in an LLC frame, and then segmented that LLC frame, or basically chopped that into cells, and then essentially put back the cells at the receiver. Okay, so packet format mapping was done very easily, whereas the address resolution problem was a big sticking point. And the third big problem was that if I wanted to map IP routing protocols to ATM signaling or to the ATM level, that became an even bigger nightmare. Okay, now IP routing protocols by themselves are more complex than IP itself. Okay, like you have protocols like OSPF and BGP. Okay, I mean BGP is a big nightmare. Okay, now we shall describe in the early part of MPL as that became even more of a problem, because the IP subnet model was completely incompatible with the ATM model and so on and so forth, which caused a lot of problems. So from two counts, the address resolution part of the puzzle, as well as the routing mapping or the adjacency mapping and hello protocols and all the standard things you do in routing, became tough. Okay, now okay. So with that introduction, let's look at what were the approaches taken to solve these problems and why they were flawed or why they were not very scalable, etc. Okay, or in general, why they increased the complexity beyond a point that the market gave up on ATM, right? Or at least gave up on ATM in terms of the LAN and so on. Okay, so first what ATM tried to do was, ATM, at least the people who designed it, were very sensitive to the idea of internet working. They saw the success of IP and they saw that if ATM were ever to replace IP, ATM would have to internet work with every possible protocol. Okay, so the first thing they said is, I can internet work with other data networking protocols at the network layer, or I can internet work with it at the LAN layer. Okay, so they looked around and said, what are the most popular protocols? They saw Ethernet was very popular. So what I want to do is I want ATM to go and replace Ethernet. Okay. So, but I don't want to change all the applications running on top of Ethernet. That was well understood. So what they wanted to do was they wanted you to buy a computer, or take your existing computer, replace your Ethernet interface, which was running at 10 megabit per second and in practice much slower at that time, with a very high speed ATM interface, which would run at 155 megabit per second. But all you need to do is change a driver. Today, if you replace your sound card, actually, I bought a new sound card for my computer. It's a fancy thing. I can do all kinds of multimedia on it. But the only thing I have to replace a driver, right? And then you're all set to go. All my applications remain unmodified. Maybe I get some new applications, right? So you can replace your Ethernet card with an ATM card, okay? And everything about the Ethernet driver remains unchanged. So you'd replace that Ethernet driver with what is known as a LAN driver. Okay, now this LAN driver stands for LAN emulation driver. So what that LAN emulation driver will do, the very simple thing, the application will give it an Ethernet frame, okay, and this LAN emulation driver will pretend to the application as though it is Ethernet, okay, and the only, that's what emulation means, right? You'll pretend, right? So, remember that even in gigabit Ethernet, it's something like LAN emulation. In gigabit Ethernet, you take the same Ethernet frame, but you do not do CSMA CD. You just have a direct link between them. So, LAN emulation does not need to replicate CSMA CD functions. That was realized by ATM people. But all LAN emulation needs to do is it needs to accept the frame format unchanged. That's all. Okay, so what ATM LAN emulation does is, you sort of stick in this interface card and put a driver, and essentially if you think of this this thing as your card, right, this card will do a function known as a LAN emulation client function. It will accept a MAC frame or an Ethernet frame unchanged, okay, and then when I have an Ethernet frame, right, now essentially I have a mapping problem, Just like if I want to map IP address to an ATM address, now I have an Ethernet address, which is a 48-bit address. Okay, remember it's an IEEE address, it's unstructured and it's a flat address space, right? And I want to map it to an ATM address, which is a 20-byte address. Okay, now I have this. So it's a similar mapping problem. I have to do address mapping. Okay, now address mapping is called ARP, right? So don't get confused when I use the word ARP here. In this context of LAN emulation, ARP means to map Ethernet packets to ATM addresses or Ethernet addresses to ATM addresses. Okay, it's just an address mapping. That's what it stands for. Now, I cannot do a broadcast from the ATM network. Okay, reason why I need to do this ARP is when this frame shows up, right? Normally in Ethernet, what you do, you just drop the frame on the bus, right? The frame will then show up at a bridge. Bridge will might filter it and then send it to other bridges, and finally it will show up at a destination LAN segment, and the destination will pick it up, right? But I don't have the luxury of doing this in an ATM network. What I have to do in the ATM network is when I see a packet, I will have to either set up a new virtual circuit to the destination, okay, which is should be directly, it should be connected on that same cloud, okay, and then send this frame to that destination. Okay, in other words, I should chop this frame into smaller cells and send off these cells to that other side, and then at the other side you reassemble all these cells, make up the frame again, and give it up. As far as the applications are concerned, I mean, they're just seeing a faster Ethernet, right? So that's the entire goal. To get that process started, you have to first set up this virtual circuit, right? To set up this virtual circuit, this interface card here needs to know not the Ethernet address, but it needs to know the ATM address of the other side's interface. So it needs to do an Ethernet address to ATM address mapping. Okay, now this problem is motivated exactly the same way as we learned IP to Ethernet address mapping. It's exactly the same problem. If I want to send an IP packet from host 1 to host 2, I will not need to know the destination Ethernet address so that I can drop the packet on the bus, okay, or in the subnet. So essentially what you can do here is, since you don't have a broadcast capability, the brain dead solution or the simplest solution is, go to a server. Okay, you have a well-known hub of information called the server. Okay, and all routers or all interface cards always have a virtual circuit, dedicated virtual circuit to that server. Okay, when a packet shows up and I don't have a mapping to the destination address, I will just send a query or an ARP request to the server, and I'll get back a reply saying what is the destination virtual circuit information. I'm sorry, what is the destination address information, and then I will set up a virtual circuit. Okay, and this is as you can see, this is a switched virtual circuit. On demand, you're setting up a virtual circuit, and once the virtual circuit is set up for subsequent MAC frames that are going to the same destination, can basically just drop it on that virtual circuit. That's almost like a wire for you, right? It's indeed a virtual wire. That's what it is. Okay, does that make sense? So the fundamental problem here is that you wanted to do the address resolution. There is no routing problem. In other words, there's no routing protocol to be mapped. Okay, so LAN emulation is probably the simplest form of internet working. So the only hitch here is the server, right? Now, the only problem with servers is that now the server, suppose you have lots of nodes, let's say we have 1,000 nodes here. It will need to maintain 1,000 virtual circuits with each of these interfaces so that it can do the resolution. So you can have the server which is sort of overloaded with information. Now, when you have a server which is overloaded or becomes single point of bottleneck, you'll have to do the standard things, like you can have a backup server and so on, right? Now, you can't just have a backup server. You need to have virtual circuits to the backup server also. Okay, so what happens is that the server-based solution, since it's virtual circuit-based, you will have to have primary backups, or you will have to divide the network into pieces and have servers serving pieces, and then servers need to talk to each other. This is essentially a bunch of distributed problem of managing servers and fault tolerance. Okay, so it was, it is solvable. Okay, the people actually solved it. There are systems which do LAN emulation and so on. But basically it raised the complexity bar to a point that the whole thing became fairly complex. Especially for people who are used to Ethernet. Ethernet is so simple to install, just plug a wire and it works, right? So here you have to go and configure some server, etc. Okay, now all this was nice until fast Ethernet emerged, okay? There was no competition to ATM. Not only could you do this, you can do all kinds of fancy things I'll talk about in a moment, like virtual LANs. I mean, there was no equivalent of it on Ethernet. You can provide quality of service within LANs, you can form virtual work groups, and you get all this 155 megabit per second, etc. You can do multimedia applications. Everything sounded great, okay? Then suddenly, from this 10 megabit, Ethernet jumped to 100 megabit, per second because fast Ethernet showed up in 94 or so. I remember I was in grad school then. So Ethernet showed up at that point of time. And then what happened was that LAN administrators did not need to learn anything new. They just need to change the interface card from Ethernet, and then hubs were auto-configuring hubs. It can figure out whether you're dealing with 10 megabit or 100 megabit Ethernet, and only constraint was to have a smaller segment length. For instead of doing 500 meters, you had to do 100 meters, that's all. And that was feasible in almost all installations. So essentially, these administrators did not need to learn how to manage a new technology. Okay, so remember that learning curves can be a huge problem in terms of adoption. Okay, and also the price of ATM was quite high at that point of time. So both of these factors basically killed ATM in the LAN world, even though it had a reasonable solution for it. Okay, so now essentially what happens in LAN emulation is you take this frame, you accept this frame, and then you put a LAN emulation header, and now you have this overall frame, and then you sort of chop it up into ATM cells and then send it over. That's the only idea. So you have other management functions. It basically targeted 802.3, which is Ethernet, and it also targeted 802.5. Even though at that point of time the FDDI was popular, it was just an extension of these frame formats. It could have been done. Okay, so functionally, or if in terms of the stack diagram, instead of having Ethernet, you have essentially replaced it with LAN and ATM. Okay, so instead of having the bus abstraction, you now have a network abstraction, a network that can be large and can scale. Okay, Ethernet came up with newer substitutes, both in terms of bandwidth, and it also allowed you to build larger and larger bridge networks. Okay, so it is around that time that the first LAN switch was introduced in early 90s. By a company, I think, called Kalpana. Okay, and then that was bought by Cisco, and then Cisco became the big LAN switching player. Okay. Okay, so LAN emulation, the idea, I mean, this looks a messy figure, but essentially the whole thing is very simple. You just have to configure. So there is an there's a configuration problem. When I bring up the card, I need to know where is the LAN emulation server, okay, which will do my address resolution. Once I know the server, okay, I can set up a permanent virtual circuit with that. And when packets show up, I can ask that server for an address resolution, form a virtual circuit, and then shuttle packets across. Okay, after I take this frame, break it up, and shuttle it across. Okay, so now LAN, by the way, not only provides unicast service, it also provides broadcast services. It also provides multicast services. So multicast services were supported through a little more complex protocol known as bus or broadcast unknown server. Okay, we'll not study that in too much detail, but that's the basic idea. Okay, now you have this messy diagram. You can take applications which are running on IP, IPX, or any kind of layer 3 protocol. These, by the way, were very popular around those times. I mean, all of these are slowly dying out, and IP is the dominant network layer right now, but novel netware and lots of other protocols were quite dominant. Okay, so now ATM wanted to be agnostic and say, I'll support all of you. Okay, one simple way to do that is to look at just replace Ethernet, and then you're ready to go. Okay, and LAN emulation will run on top of AAL5, which is the adaptation layer which was designed for data. Okay, and then that maps it to ATM cells. This essentially does segmentation reassembly. And it will, so the other major function of AAL5 is that when I have a frame, right, it will chop it up into smaller cells. It will set a bit called 0, I mean, bit of 0 in every bit of maybe 0 or 1. And only the last cell will have the opposite bit setting. Essentially, it will say that there are more bits, more cells coming, and this is the last cell. And ATM guarantees that in a virtual circuit, all cells go sequentially. Cells will never be ordered, never be misordered in ATM virtual circuit. So AL5's job of segmentation reassembly is very simple. I think we saw an example of segmentation reassembly in the context of X.25, right? The method of AL5 is very similar. So AL5 is a very lightweight adaptation protocol that takes a frame and then maps it to ATM. Okay, and then you can use any physical layer you like. Okay, then you can also bridge ATM to other non-ATM networks, like other Ethernet segments which have not yet been converted over. Okay, so what is interesting here? So the things you need to keep in mind is that LAN emulation can also be implemented largely in software. The only thing you need to change is the actual ATM card. And you can have, essentially the key pieces are the LAN emulation server called LES, and there's a configuration server which tells you where the server is. Okay, now this is, there is a default address for this, and this you can have a variable floating address. And then we did not study this in much in detail, called broadcast and unknown server. So the LAN emulation process is that I first get the address of the LAN emulation server, that is the server's address. It's called the initialization phase, and then you register its list of MAC addresses and form a virtual circuit with that server. And then when a packet shows up, you do address resolution, okay, by sending an ARP request on that permanent virtual circuit. And then once you have gotten the resolved address, you set up a virtual circuit from the client to the other client. Okay, and if you want to do broadcast, essentially the way it happens is that you send the packet you want to broadcast or multicast to this broadcast server, and then the broadcast server essentially relays it to all other nodes. Okay, the way it does that relaying is, instead of setting up separate virtual circuits with every node, it will set up a point to multipoint virtual circuit. So remember that point to multipoint is something like multicast, right? So you can set up a point to multipoint circuit with all other things, and then essentially take the packet and then throw it on this point to multipoint circuit. Yeah?
And you said that the emulation server, it translates a MAC address to an ATM address. But how do we get the MAC address in the first place?
Okay, the question is, the LAN emulation server translates MAC address to ATM address, but how do you get the MAC address in the first place?
ARP, we right. Send out the IP address of the destination.
That's a good question. Okay, so now when you're doing IP over Ethernet, and which now you're replacing that Ethernet over ATM, what happens is, see, when IP will try to do an ARP, right, IP doesn't know anything about LAN and all that, right? So IP is trying to do an ARP, and ARP is naturally a broadcast, right? So essentially at the LAN level, right, I'm essentially seeing a packet that needs to be broadcast to all nodes. Okay, now it will send it to the broadcast and unknown server. And that broadcast and unknown server can send, do a broadcast, and then you get back a reply. Now what you can do is you can sort of snoop in this whole process and then figure out what the destination's ATM address is. That is also allowed. That's one of the optimizations which is done. Another way in which you can get your MAC address is by software configuration. When you are doing a novel netware and other types of things, right? So you can figure out where you want to communicate with at the software level. You can be configured with software MAC addresses and so on and so forth. So there are two ways to do that. Okay. So as you can see, essentially you have IP over Ethernet. There is an overlay model there, and then you have Ethernet emulation over ATM, or LAN emulation over ATM, right? So there are two levels of indirection, and this whole process gets messy because each of these indirections is done different way, right? Okay, so another feature which LAN provides is the capability of doing virtual LANs. Okay, what a virtual LAN means is that you have this sort of cloud here, but then you can split up the nodes of this cloud into groups. Okay, and this is good for enterprise networks because they want to have work groups and assign different amount of bandwidth for different work groups, etc. So the way you would do is that essentially instead of actually building two LANs like this and putting a router in between, you can just have a single ATM switch or an ATM cloud here, and you connect a router to that cloud. Okay, and on these two sides you have a LAN server, or these two LAN servers can actually be physically implemented on a single LAN server as well. Okay, so these are two logical LAN servers. Okay, so and then when you do address resolution, you make sure that A's cannot see the B's. That's all. Okay, so that's about what a virtual LAN does. Okay, now today what happens is that Ethernet has matured to a point that you can do virtual LAN on Ethernet itself. Okay, and this is only possible on a switched Ethernet network. Okay, and we are not going to cover all the switched Ethernet business. But if you take any Cisco manual or anything which talks about LAN switches, it'll give you a specification for how you want to do virtual LANs with them. Okay, and the method is fairly similar. You just want to make sure that you put some tags or something in packets so that you differentiate one work group from the other. Excuse me. Okay, so we move on. And the other type of internetworking is, instead of trying to internetwork at the Ethernet level, let's bring ATM to one more level. That is, try to map IP directly to ATM, right? Rather than mapping IP over Ethernet and then trying to replace Ethernet. Okay, now this is interesting because Ethernet is a LAN technology, and Ethernet is not found inside an ISP, for example. Inside an ISP, what happens is that you have IP running over PPP and running over point-to-point links, right? Like a leased line or something like that. Now you want to replace that with IP running over ATM, right? So essentially what you want to do is you want to take PPP and throw it on top of ATM, but at the same time you also want to do address resolution for IP. Okay, so essentially it's a mix of trying to map PPP to ATM as well as it's a mix of trying to map IP directly to ATM in terms of both its address resolution as well as its routing protocols. Okay, so that is, so the whole thing is specified in a bunch of documents. So this work was undertaken both by the ATM forum as well as the IETF, which are two different standard bodies. Okay. Now, whenever I use the word RFC, this refers to an IETF specification. So the packet encapsulation was specified in RFC 1483. Okay. It's fairly straightforward RFC. And then, the address resolution was specified in RFC 1577. Okay. Now, this was fairly good solution, but then they wanted to, if you looked at ISPs which were fairly large, like say AT&T's ISP or UUNet or some fairly big ISP, okay, it turned out that you wanted to have more flexibility in mapping IP to ATM, and we'll study about that. There were some limitations in this RFC, and they tried to solve that through a series of RFCs. One RFC stands for Next Hop Routing Protocol or NHRP. And then they tried to combine all these into one big specification, okay? And then to handle multicast, like just IP, just like you had multicast at the LAN level, they also wanted to support multicast at the IP level, right? Like IP multicast. But and that specification was known as MARS, okay? So it's essentially it's like address resolution. AR stands for address resolution. So essentially, you're doing multicast address resolution service, okay? That's what this stands for. So you see that the fundamental problem in internet networking, one of the fundamental problems is address resolution, okay? And I can't overemphasize how big that is, okay? And even though Lane pulled off a fairly straightforward server-based address resolution strategy, it became far more cumbersome to do the same thing for any of these solutions, okay? So essentially what happens is that I have some kind of a LAN, and then I have this ATM carrier network or a ISP here. And at this internet networking point, I'm getting IP packets and I want to map it to ATM, right? So at the, in the data plane, I use RFC 1483, which does the packet format mapping. And I said this is a well-solved problem. It's an easily solved problem. It takes user traffic. It forms PPP frames or what are known as LLC frames and just sort of stripes them using AL5. Throws them on the ATM network, assuming that the virtual circuit exists, and then reassembles it on the other side. Okay, that's all RFC 1483 is. Very easy. Okay, but the other problem was when I get an IP address, I need to know where to send it, or I need to know where to establish the virtual circuit. Exactly the same problem as LAN emulation. Okay, but only difference is that this ATM network is now considerably larger. Okay, so, I mean, they tried the exact same solution, right? They wanted to have a server, just like the LAN emulation server. The server was called an ATM ARP server. Okay, now just the word is different, but essentially the function is similar. You want to map IP address to ATM address rather than mapping Ethernet address to ATM address. So that is defined by what's known as an ATM ARP server, and it's a server-based strategy. Okay, and the other feature I'll talk about in one moment. Okay. Okay, so packet encapsulation. Suppose you want to send multiple protocols on top of ATM, assuming that a virtual circuit has been set up. RFC 1483 provides a multi-protocol packet encapsulation service, and essentially what that allows, I mean, it's a fancy name for saying that set up one single pipe and I can carry all kinds of transport protocols. So it's not just specific to IP. It allows you to essentially specify a multiplexing field and say what is the protocol type that is being carried, okay, and you can map all of that on top. Okay, it's nothing very fancy. It's very straightforward. So what you do is you form an LLC frame, okay, that is you take this layer 3 packet and you form this LLC frame, which is nothing but just like an PPP header. Okay, that's all it is. Okay, so in this LLC frame, there's one 8-byte quantity where you can specify what is the type of the protocol you're carrying, and there's some framing header and so on. And then you specify an AL5 trailer, which is nothing but a CRC. Okay, it's similar to an Ethernet trailer. Okay, that's all. And so that is 1483. Okay, probably the more contentious issue was this ATM ARP. Okay, conceptually it was very similar. I want to get an IP address which is looks like this, and I want to convert that into an ATM address which resembles a 20 byte address. Okay, now, so this keeps going on and on, right? So I have a huge address. So this is like an address resolution protocol. The solution proposed was ATM ARP servers. Okay, but then that was not the only thing. What they did was the other new concept which 1577 RFC proposed, which is also termed as a classical IP over ATM mapping protocol. Essentially, not only do you propose an ATM ARP server, but it allows you to take a big ATM network and then break it up and define logical boundaries in this ATM network. Okay, and this and essentially you can take an IP subnet and map it to one of these LISs. Okay, so this LIS1 stands for logical, what is that called? I think IP subnet, that's what it is. Logical IP subnet, that's what it stands for. And essentially this is one IP subnet and this is another IP subnet. Okay, if you remember your IP fundamentals, what it means is that if you want to go from one subnet to other, remember that subnet is also demarcates broadcast, right? If I want to cross from one subnet to the other, I will have to go through a router. This is according to the IP specifications. So what it meant is that to connect multiple subnets, I will have to go through a router. And by the way, this router is sitting on an ATM network. So if I want to transfer packets from A1 to B2, even though it is sitting on the same ATM network, that is, if this IP business were not there, I could set up a single virtual circuit from A to B. Now what I'll have to do is I'll have to actually set up one ATM circuit from A1 to the router here. Okay, now I'm also, remember at that time routers were very slow. Okay, and it were much slower compared to ATM switches. So then the slow router needs to shuttle this packet across, and it will have to form another circuit from here to B2. Okay, and then only then, so essentially you're trying to bridge, but at the bridge of the network layer over here. So, and each of these will have its own ATM ARP server, and you have to manage this. Okay, now you start seeing why this whole thing becomes messy, right? Excuse me. So now you have this problem that even though I have two nodes on the same network, I cannot have what is known as a cut-through virtual circuit. I cannot cut through this mess of logical IP stuff. Okay, so wait, let me just skip over one thing. So obviously to solve that problem, right, they came up with another RFC, okay, which is called NHRP. It's standard for Next Hop Resolution Protocol. Now observe that, I mean, this name contains all the answers, what you want. So not only do you want to do address resolution, okay, but you didn't want to go through these routers. Okay, so the routers, if they can figure out what is the next hop and what is the next hop's ATM address and tell the first the original host, you can cut through this logical boundaries and form a single virtual circuit. Okay, so what these so this NHRP servers are similar to ATM ARP servers. The only difference is that they can take an ATM ARP request and then forward it to other NHRP servers in different in their appropriate logical IP subnets. Okay, and so this request sort of goes till it goes to the final subnet where the host is, okay, the destination is, and then essentially this host, by the way, could also be behind a bridge network, etc. And then you get back a reply, and this reply is again shuttled back all the way through the sequence of NHRP servers, and you tell the host. Okay, now this host knows that, oh, now I'm in the same ATM network, big realization, and then I can form a virtual circuit directly. So I run ATM signaling, set up a circuit, and now I'm all hunky-dory, right? So now I can send my packets using 1483 encapsulation. Okay, all this sounds great in practice, okay, but you see that now I have this huge chain of servers, and each of these could be unreliable, etc., right? So the function of the router to shuttle packets has been reduced, but when people try to actually build ATM NHRP servers and so on, they found some weird problems, okay, when NHRP servers had to coexist with IP routing, and they could form stable loops, routing loops. Okay. In fact, I'm not too familiar with all the minor details of this. But so there were several corner cases in which the whole thing will not even work. Okay. So even though it was a matter of just relaying address resolution, as part of this relay business, you will also have to make sure that you internetwork the routing side of things. Okay. One more reason why this breakup was done in the first place was because IP routing did not scale. IP routing, right, even though if you, I don't know whether you guys took my took internet protocols before, but if you've not, I have audio lectures online. You can go and brush up your routing fundamentals in terms of the internet protocols. If you go to my webpage and click on the IP page, right? At least for the routing part, both OSPF and as well as the basic routing, there are lectures there. So I'd strongly encourage you to go and look at that. But essentially the problem is this. Routing also, at the end of the day, translates into some sort of flooding, okay? You send, in the link state protocols, you sort of flood link state announcements. So you cannot do this for a network that has more than about 200 subnets, okay? In other words, you cannot do this more than 200 routers or so. Okay, but today the scalability limits have increased substantially, but at that time, you couldn't do more than 50 or 100 routers. So if I have a large network like AT&T, AT&T network, for example, today has about 20,000 routers. Okay, now you cannot organize that as a single flat routing domain as far as the IP side is concerned. So this, they had to introduce an artificial boundary because the IP routing side could not scale. Okay, so that is the rationale for this boundary. And once you establish the boundary, you cannot have this cut-through routing, cut-through ATM-VC establishment, which became a problem. Okay, so that is a part of the story which we have not covered. Okay, so I said there were two main problems, right? Address resolution was a problem, and then packet format mapping was a solved problem, and then the other problem is mapping routing protocols. Okay, so routing protocols implied this logical boundary stuff. Okay, and that started off a new set of problems. And primarily it led to complicating the address resolution part also. Address resolution had to now go through a relay of NHRP servers. Okay, so that is the short story of what happened. And the interactions between NHRP and routing within a domain led to packets going through all kinds of weird loops sometimes, okay, the worst case. Okay, then another protocol that was specified was known as MARS. It stands for Multicast Address Resolution. Now, if you remember IP multicast specifies a destination multicast group, and you have multicast tables that are formed through IP multicast routing protocols, and then you do IP multicast. Okay, now MARS essentially try to support IGMP, and these are all standard IP multicast routing protocols. Again, you can go to my webpage to see if you want to brush up your IP multicast fundamentals. It's right there. But we are not going into this in great detail, okay? The reason, because multicast itself is dead in internet, okay? So there's no point trying to study IP multicast, which is dead, over ATM, which is also dead, okay? Okay, so essentially the summary of the story is that there were two major solutions, okay? At the IP level, you had an NHRP protocol that was specified, which is an extension of the RFC 1577 or classical IP over ATM model. And at the LAN level, there was a protocol specified by the ATM forum called LAN emulation. Okay, now, essentially ATM forum undertook a new effort to take the best of both worlds, essentially offer a single solution called MPOA, which could be implemented in all ATM switches, and it will allow you to internetwork either with a LAN or with an IP and so on and so forth. Okay, and this solution was called MPOA. I'm sorry, question? Somebody?
Sorry.
Okay, so this MPOA essentially was to combine NHRP and LAN emulation, and it also combined the multicast address resolution service. Okay, so and it also made some improvements in terms of NHRP. Okay, but that's something we're not going to study. But MPOA obviously inherits all the complexities of both. Okay, now you can imagine why this whole mapping process, even just looking at the data plane, address resolution and packet format resolution, has become fairly complex. Okay, now at the beginning of the next lecture, we'll also look at why the control plane mapping became even more complex. Okay, so the end of the day was that there was no very good solution for the overlay model of mapping IP to ATM. Okay. And there exist solutions, but these were fairly complex. You couldn't have very low-cost solutions for doing that. Okay, and that is because of the fundamental philosophy mismatch between IP and ATM, and the way IP is connectionless, whereas ATM is connection-oriented, and so on. Okay, and it's not a broadcast medium. Those are the even though the ideas, no broadcast and virtual circuit, those were the only two major differences. But those had a fundamental impact and dramatically increased the complexity of mapping one to the other. Okay. And seemingly for a period of time, no end was in sight. Okay, there was no clear solution to this whole thing. They thought, because the conventional wisdom was that either you do internet working by using an overlay model, or you do internet working by using a translation type model. Okay, sometimes it's called a peer-to-peer model for whatever reason, but translation model. And both of them didn't work out. Okay, then magically a third solution appeared called MPLS. Okay, we'll study that in a moment. Okay, which is still out there. Okay, so MPOA essentially uses this NHRP stuff, next hop resolution servers, and it can use it both in a LAN emulation context as well as like IP over ATM emulation context. Okay, I'm not going to go into the details, but essentially it's a combination of LAN emulation as well as NHRP. Okay, so if you look at the Gori diagram of ATM networks with all this stuff built in, and look at where these dotted lines are, which essentially specify the interfaces, you could have native ATM hosts which operate by implementing the private UNI. Okay, so essentially this is just an ATM card, and it implements the ATM stack, and applications are modified to directly operate on top of ATM, and the entire protocol set is known as a private UNI, okay, or user to network interface. Routers implement either the private NNI or the public UNI. Okay, public UNI means this is an enterprise network, and I'm connecting to a carrier network. That's called the public UNI. But within an enterprise network, I could still run routing protocols like PNNI, right? That's an example of a private NNI protocol. Or I could have other sort of interfaces like frame UNI, okay, for the frame emulation service. Or I could have a sort of inter-networking interface like LANE, NHRP, or MPOA. Okay, and then once you have passed all this complex interfaces inside the network, you just have this nice collection of ATM switches which do high-speed packet forwarding, and switching technology dramatically improved with ATM networks. Okay, so the moral of the story is that, okay, you can build an architecture which has a lot of good ideas, but the whole thing can still die, okay, because of considerations usually which result in complexity or which increase the user's cost for deploying the network or managing the network. Okay, and that's what killed ATM, and especially when there was a competition in terms of Ethernet, which was well entrenched in the LAN side. ATM is still widely deployed in internet cores. Widely is the keyword. I mean, if you go to any carrier network, you will see quite a lot of ATM deployed, and this, hopefully all this terminology will help you if you ever run into one of them. Okay, and the mapping from IP to ATM either uses MPOA, okay, which is again fairly widely deployed, or it uses MPLS, which I shall talk about in this. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so to give you an idea of where we are in the big picture, so we've covered sort of several of the telephony-oriented broadband protocols. Okay, now we are going to get into protocols that are sort of hybrid of the telephony world as well as the data world, okay, and also purely connectionless protocols for doing similar functions. Okay, so that is where the world is progressing. People are trying to simplify all this connection-oriented stuff and take the essential ideas into largely connectionless infrastructure, so that you can take these ideas and retrofit them into protocols like OSPF and BGP, etc. Okay, now once you do that, people are again taking ideas from ATM like quality of service and so on, and then bringing them to the IP world. Okay, and another set of ideas is what is called traffic engineering, survivability, and so on. So that is the set of ideas we'll study over the next couple of weeks or so, next 2-3 weeks. Okay, and once we're done through that, by the way, one of the other key things we missed is how do you actually build a high-speed router? When you say broadband, everything has to be fast, right, including the router itself. And so that starts with the switch fabric and the port mapping algorithm, what is called a forwarding algorithm. And how are modern routers designed? Okay, how did routers solve the problem of coming up with high-speed forwarding and high-speed switching services, which was originally thought of only a telephony problem or an ATM problem? Okay, so that was another debate which got resolved. So today, terabit routers are available, okay, which can process packets very, very fast. Okay, and another wave of things which are happening right now around this time is there is a new kind of things taking off called network processors. Okay, now just like Intel dominated the processor market, now it is trying to convert many of these functions which a router does into a general purpose programmable interface called a network processor. And actually there are other competitors to Intel, but Intel is a dominant player. So, and then it's offering that network processor as a core to manufacturers like Cisco and so on. Then they can run an operating system like Cisco's iOS on top of it, and they can build a router in no time, okay, at a much lower cost. Okay, so we'll look at switching and how computer engineering is meeting network engineering when we talk about building high-speed routers and network processors probably in the next class. Now we're going to go a little more into the architectural concepts of MPLS, okay? That's the roadmap. Okay. So, by the way, today you should have gotten a homework. So, the homework will cover, I think, a bunch of chapters related to the slides that we just saw, and also cover this label switching in MPLS. Excuse me. Okay. So far all the homeworks have been primarily sort of a true or false type questions, because, I mean, all I've been doing so far is cracking through a whole bunch of concepts. Later we'll start getting to something which is more numerically involved and so on. Okay, right now, since it's conceptual, it's better evaluate it through a bunch of true false questions so that you know exactly, you need to have a surgical understanding of what each thing is. Okay, so we get into label switching. Okay, now label switching and MPLS basically originated from the IP over ATM debate. Okay, how do I build core networks which are fairly large, which can support IP, okay, but which can transcend the scalability limitations of IP, okay, and it will also give ISPs considerable flexibility to optimize the network in terms of traffic and to optimize the network in terms of services, and also take the network from low speed to high speed. Okay, that was the broad debate. And the solution that was first proffered was ATM and then IP over ATM, which did not work out, okay. But then all these concepts are gradually moving over to MPLS, and then this area is broadly also called IP switching, which was introduced by one of the startup companies of the time called Ypsilon, and we'll look at the history of that. Okay, and MPLS is basically a generalization of concepts which we've seen so far, like labels and so on, doing source routing, decoupling of the control plane from the data plane, and all those nice things, and what you can do with it. But you have a lot more flexibility in MPLS. It's a sort of a hybrid. It can use ATM cores, which is, I mean, you can take ATM hardware and run ATM MPLS on top. You can take frame relay hardware, or you can even just upgrade ATM boxes, existing ATM boxes with a software upgrade and make it MPLS boxes. Okay, so, MPLS also face competition in terms of pure IP routers. Okay, and that is going to be the next class. Okay, and we'll have a very brief introduction to the idea of traffic engineering, and traffic engineering will be a topic you can take in a little more detail later. Okay, so just to recap the philosophy of this whole thing, IP, remember, has this best effort philosophy. Okay, it is very, very well architected to be consistent with this philosophy of moving all functions to the end systems and end-to-end architecture, but then leave the internal implementation flexible. The only thing that was complex about internal stuff was the routing. Okay, and that was fairly complex on its own. It was based upon the simple realization that you cannot predict the future. Okay, so you kept the whole thing reasonable and flexible and so on. And if I look at the control plane evolution of IP, that is where this whole debate started. Control plane was just good enough. In fact, if you look at the history of IP, the first control plane protocol that was proposed was RIP, okay, which is the distance vector routing protocol. That thing never scaled, okay? You can't scale it more than a few hops, like about 15 hops, that's it. You cannot build a network larger than that, okay? How can I build larger IPA, okay? So what they said is, okay, now let's form a boundary around this. Let's call this an autonomous system and then run an exterior gateway protocol called BGP. And then BGP ran into scalability problems and so on, okay? So how do you build large IP networks? That was the general question. So they wanted to build large intra-domain protocols, okay? And just in time, a solution came to replace distance vector with a link state protocol, that instead of having just 10 routers or so, 10 to 15 routers, you can have hundreds of routers. Okay, it started off with about 50 routers and so on, but today you can build OSPF areas with fairly large numbers of routers, hundreds of routers you can build. Okay, in fact, if you look at AT&T network or any big network, they have thousands of routers. Okay, and they are organized into multiple OSPF areas, but essentially you can build a large autonomous system, and within that autonomous system, it's just a single inter-domain protocol. Okay, and now OSPF, whenever we speak of OSPF, there is also another competing protocol called ISIS. Now, ISIS is probably one of the sole survivors of the OSI stack. Okay, if whenever we learn networking, we learn about the 7-layer model, right? Okay, probably what you don't learn is that most of it is dead. Okay, but because most of it never saw the light of day. Okay, because it was overly complex. But what did see the light of day was one of the routing protocols of that. And that was a connectionless routing protocol. I mean, it was meant as a routing protocol to support the connectionless service of OSI, and that was called ISIS. Okay, now the word IS is a lingo in OSI terminology. It stands for intermediate system. Okay, so intermediate system to intermediate system basically means it's a router to router protocol. What else is a routing protocol? That's what it does, right? So ISIS is an example of a link state protocol. It has lots of similarities with OSPF. Again, I have a much more detailed lecture on this online. Okay, you're welcome to go and take a look at it if you want to study all the differences. Okay, OSPF and ISIS were just good enough to build fairly scalable networks. Then they again ran into scalability problems, and it was okay to support best effort service on this kind of an infrastructure. But suddenly people wanted to offer virtual private networks. They wanted to support, the whole world on top of IP. They want to support virtual private, I talked about voice over IP, they wanted to support multimedia and all this stuff. But then OSPF and ISIS had one key problem. They were not converging fast enough. Suppose a link went down and you had some service on top of that link, like say some quality of service based thing which was on top of that link, right? Now it will take another a few seconds for that service to be restored, right? So all that link has gone down. So all the packets of this flow will be dropped, will continue to be dropped for a few seconds. So obviously this is not a good service compared to Sonnet. Remember, Sonnet provides you almost instantaneous remapping of traffic. Within 50 milliseconds, your traffic can go somewhere else. So more recently, actually as recent as 2001, there have been new developments within OSPF and ISIS to basically redesign several pieces of the protocol, especially the rate at which you compute all the Dijkstra's algorithm. There are new incremental Dijkstra's algorithm and so on. And you optimize some foolish mistakes that were done in those earlier times to essentially have sub-second convergence, or called millisecond convergence. Within a few milliseconds, if a link goes down, you can reroute, you can provide route. Okay, but still there are limitations within OSPF. And in fact, if you go to NANOG stands for North American Network Operators Group. And one reason this is interesting is they have, again, videos. Okay, so people come, good industry people come give talks, and the whole thing is video recorded, presentations are available. And there are, in that particular NANOG, which was held just last June, there are lots of interesting videos and papers on how to fix link state routing for fast convergence. Okay, so the overall goal is that I want to make IP, you can't just sell best effort, you want to make it business, okay, or you want to sell business service on top of it. So there are two ways of looking at business: either make me money and don't lose me money, okay, save me money, okay, and then make me money, right? So in terms of don't lose me money, make sure that this whole network is up, okay, there's availability. So if you look at today's service level agreements for IP, there are availability guarantees, etc. And then make me money is all those new services and equivalence of phone services like voice over IP and so on. Okay, now we'll break for a few minutes and then come back to the next lecture.